from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. On Sunday, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman called for a National Commission on Violence in the wake of the Newtown Massacre. The commission would look at the country's mental health system, as well as gun laws and other factors. Could better access to mental health services help prevent future tragedies? We'll discuss mental illness, public policy, and the psychology of mass murderers. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. And in this Forum hour, in light of Friday's tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, that ended the lives of 20 young schoolchildren ages 6 and 7 and 6 adults, as well as the death of the suicide perpetrator, we turn our attention to mental health, services for the mentally ill, and public policy in the wake of tragedies like the one at Sandy Hook Elementary and previous mass killings in Portland, Aurora, Tucson, Virginia Tech, or what we've seen in the way of senseless and wanton violence. How much is it tied to public mental health issues, and how much needs to be done on those scores? Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour here. Melissa Naw is with us in studio. She's Medical Director of Psychiatric Emergency Services with San Francisco General Hospital, also Assistant Clinical Professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and welcome.
Thank you.
We'll also say good morning to John Green, who's here in studio as well, a psychiatrist, board-certified in general and forensic psychiatry, teaches psychiatry and law at Stanford School of Medicine. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Greg Sancier, who is a former officer and hostage negotiator for the San Jose Police Department, has a Ph.D. in clinical psychology, and now works as a danger assessment consultant for business and law enforcement and the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. And welcome, Greg Sancier.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, Melissa Naw, with you, if I may, and let's just talk about, you know, we tend to see all of these and try to see them separately because each is separate in its own way, but is there anything to glean from these tragedies, and I listed some of them, in terms of, I mean, we, for example, we hear lone shooter and depression and zombie-like and on meds or off the meds, or, I mean, are there any things that really particularly stand out for you?
Thank you, Michael. I think, you know, the most important thing to begin with is that most people who are violent are not mentally ill, and most people with mental illness are not violent. So I think we tend to, when tragedies like this happen, point a finger at the mental illness and say that this is the main problem. But
well, thank you for that. In fact, the proportion is no different than the regular general population.
Right, correct.
But do we see something in these particular, and one's assuming that there's real mental illness here in many of these cases, that stands out to you?
You know, I can't comment on Adam Lanza and whether or not he suffered from a mental illness at this point. But certainly, you know, when somebody becomes more separated from society, more depressed, more disenfranchised, I would say those are things to be paying attention to and things to watch out for. I think that most of these crimes tend to come actually from hate, and I don't think that that can be attributed to a particular diagnosis.
Hate or rage? You know, you're reading about, we're not going to go in a diagnostic mode here with Adam Lanza yet, but there's a lot of speculation about him being a genius, and some of these young men are high in the IQ department, but they seem to be, in fact, there was an article that Lisa Lang wrote that went all over the internet, which I believe you're
yes,
nodding your head so you saw, and she said, had a child who was totally out of control. He could be sweet and read Harry Potter and play with teddy bears, but then he was completely out of control with his rage and violence, and she was helpless.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think you know, rage is absolutely a part of it. I think that the interesting thing about Lisa's article is that it raises the point that children can come from perfectly loving homes and loving, warm families and still end up with difficulties with mental illness. And likewise, children from quite tragic home environments don't end up with those kinds of problems, emotional problems.
Well, this is, I suspect, John Green, something that does rise to a level of understanding, at least the sense of these people being loners, unable to make kind of social communication or follow social cues or being able to really communicate.
Yes, and I think what you're discussing is that these individuals, all of those examples that you gave are those elements that they have, inability to interact with society, inability maybe to regulate their emotions. That all is mental illness. I mean, that's something that should be treated. You know, in your last hour, you had mentioned that one in four people owns a gun. There's another very solid statistic is that one in four people suffers from mental illness of some degree, which means that mental illness is a pervasive issue. And I think Adam Lanza is an example of an extreme level of mental illness that's an extreme situation, rather, of mental illness that's not checked.
So forgive me, just to put these 2 hours together for the moment, I mean, what you're suggesting, I think, subtextually or maybe even overtly, is that when you have the greater accessibility of guns, it's going to be more likelihood for these kind of volatile individuals to either kill themselves or kill other people.
Yes, I think that the problem is that Adam Lanza most likely had issues a long time ago, and I think if we had resources to assess that early on, we wouldn't have gotten to this point of Adam Lanza doing what he did last Friday. And I think that it's really important. Obviously, your last hour was a huge debate about the gun issue and problems with guns. You had one caller, Stephanie, come in and say, call in and say, "Hey, you know, this kind of speaks to mental illness." That's from my standpoint. I can look at all of these tragedies and see, yeah, there's something going on there with mental illness, and this is probably more reflective of a policy issue about how mental illness is not addressed enough.
And again, John Green is a psychiatrist and teaches psychiatry at Stanford School of Medicine. Greg Satsier is also with us, former officer and hostage negotiator with the San Jose PD, and now works with danger assessment as a consultant. Greg, we're talking about the same number in the population, the general population, as those mentally ill prone to violence, but 1 out of 7 people with developmental disorders, and that's a high number, are given to the potential of violence. And I know you've been going by Fuller Torrey, someone I admire a great deal, who's probably done some of the best work on schizophrenia.
And absolutely.
He tells us that there are really ways to identify these people.
Yeah, there are. But obviously it's difficult to make those assessments. And much of my work is what you would call pre-assessment with some of the indicators that might demonstrate that someone might have the potential for dangerousness. And I recently wrote an article on police interaction with the dangerously mentally ill. And there's certain criteria that exist that Dr. Torrey has done the research. And anecdotally speaking, my experience on the street as a hostage negotiator and as a crisis intervention specialist has shown that when these certain conditions exist, and one of which is people that have severe mental illness, if they have something called command hallucinations, where some outside source, in many cases it could be God, Martians, Aaron Bassler up in Northern California.
He's a Mendocino, yeah.
Yes, recently, and had schizophrenia, they feel. But the issue that we're discussing here is many times it's pre-diagnosis. Many of the times they have not been diagnosed yet. I do community psychology in where I live, and I was recently approached by a woman whose son has been parking on the street, living out of his truck. People in the neighborhood are fearful of him. He has tirades, outbursts, even against the children. She came to me and said, had heard about me, and what can I do? Well, it's just it's a gigantic effort on not only my part, but it's law enforcement, mental health, the officers in the district, and something that we call crisis intervention team training, where certain police officers are now trained that have the capability to do an analysis, albeit not like Dr. Green or Dr. Now would do, but because we're talking about on the streets.
More training, but less resources, too.
Absolutely.
And what do you tell the person, for example, who's living with the child who's out of control, like we were talking about before? They have to lock their own bedroom doors at night, that sort of thing. I mean, we keep hearing about this.
Well, sadly, that's one of the telltale indicators that I ask families. I said, are you presently locking your door? Are you that fearful? And the woman I talked to recently said, well, I've changed all the locks in my house. So what's necessary is someone that has the capability to make it a, if you will, a street-level assessment on the individual to see if they present with any of the issues that could lend itself to the potential for violence. But that takes time. And we know that the crisis intervention team training that I conducted at San Jose and with the help of Dr. Green, I might add, does help in terms of making those beginnings of those assessments on the street. It's something that is very time-consuming, and a lot of agencies really don't have the wherewithal to be able to conduct those assessments.
Could we say, Dr. Green, that if we had kind of the data here in some of these cases, whether it was in Tucson, Arizona, or just happening all Portland, Newtown, Connecticut, that with the proper help, perhaps these could have been prevented? Or can we be assured of that?
We can't be assured of it, but I can tell you from my experience, I see issues all the time where people have mental illness and it's not being addressed by anybody for a long period of time. Once it is addressed, it's not followed through effectively because the resources aren't there. I'm sure Dr. Na can mention this many times. I'm sure she sees hundreds of people with mental illness that she has to treat very briefly and then turn away. I mean, the issue really is access and long-term access and resources. Like, for example, if maybe 6 weeks ago in place for whatever reason in Connecticut there was a crisis intervention team or there was some sort of resources, something where actually professionals actually go out and kind of look for at-risk people to assess them, to see how they're doing.
Well, there are a lot of them going under the radar screen. This kid was apparently like this. Even one of his counselors said
exactly.
He didn't feel any pain. You know, I mean, right. He could have brought that to the attention of and maybe gotten them some help, but nobody did because he's sort of in that, I think you call it the middle zone, don't you, Greg?
Right.
I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people aren't – so it's several levels. It's also people in general not really understanding mental illness, not wanting to understand mental illness, not knowing about it. You know, I've done – first talk I did out of residency was to the National Alliance for Mentally Ill, and the audience was individuals who have people with mental illness. So they're there. They've had people in the system. And after my talk, I was swamped by individuals asking me questions like, you know, my relative I have these symptoms. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? All this question about
all the helplessness is really what you're getting, isn't it?
Helplessness, pervasive helplessness, inability for people in society to, one, to assess it, two, to acknowledge it, three, to get some sort
and
of help.
And also to get over the stigma of it, too. I mean, this is so major in this. But let me go back to Dr. Na on this. In the wake of these tragedies, you keep hearing, well, antidepressants, there may be causing this. Or maybe they get off their meds, and that's caused by being off of the antidepressants. I mean, you hear both arguments, and a lot of antidepressants, a lot of, even things like Zoloft, we don't necessarily know. We don't have great longitudinal studies, although we know that most people can take them okay. But we keep hearing about suicidal impact of some of these drugs and so forth. And then people who aren't on their drugs and they go off, help us understand, you know, and sort through this because they're really conflicting.
Well, I mean, I think certainly proper assessment, diagnosis, and treatment is of the utmost importance, and I think nobody would disagree with that. I don't think it makes – I don't agree with the blaming of the medications. I think that if the medications – if a person is assessed and treated properly with the right medications, it is not going to be the medication that causes them to act out or have a violent behavior. I think the media has sensationalized some of the data around increased risk of suicidality with antidepressants, for example. In fact, in a lot of cases, the increased risk of suicidality comes from the antidepressant helping a person actually start to have energy again to then carry out the plan that they've had all along for suicide, for example. So I don't think blaming the medications actually helps us understand the real root of the problem at all.
But if we want to be more preventative, there's always the danger of infringement of civil liberties.
I think, yes, absolutely. And I think to what our the other two guests have mentioned today, I think there is this middle ground of people for whom everybody would agree the behavior is concerning, they're becoming more withdrawn, more socially isolated, whatnot, but we don't actually have the ability to confine everybody. And I think it raises an interesting societal question. Should we have that ability? And I don't think we've found the right balance, because I think that there are a number of people for whom increased treatment, increased intervention would be appropriate, helpful, relevant. And yet at the same time, we can't just lock everybody up just because we're worried about them. And absolutely, this is what I see often in the ER, where people come in. They come in with family members who are concerned about them. The family members have excellent points. We realize that there's an increased risk here, but we can't just admit them to the hospital for ongoing care unless there's an imminent risk of danger to themselves or other people.
And Greg Sancier, I mentioned an article before about Lisa, by a woman named Lisa Lang, that appeared online and became quickly read by people on the social networks and so forth. And she said the only way she could get help for her child was to have him go through the prison system.
Well, unfortunately, in these times, that's still a very prevalent issue. And when I was working in the crisis management unit at San Jose Police, I'd have people call me, even psychiatrists and psychologists, and say, Greg, you know, what can we do? And I'd say, sadly and unfortunately, one of the only places that they can begin to get the help and begin to get assessed is in the criminal justice system. And I've spoken before about Dr. Stephen Manley in San Jose, who's incredible with his mental health / drug court at giving people the assistance, yet having the law enforcement and the mental health sides combine to try to enable them to get the care that they need, but they make them responsible for their behaviors and getting the help that they need. The problem is one of, I mean, Dr. Green alluded to it, is stigma and discrimination. I was on the State of California Mental Health Advisory Commission for just that. And the stigma and discrimination out there against the mental illness is so pervasive that what we need to do is perhaps educate our people more about that. But as the doctor mentioned also, I think the media, to a great degree, has hurt the cause to try to appropriately educate people as to what mental illness is and is not. And certainly, as we've talked about, most people with mental illness are not dangerous. But there's a small percentage, they fit the criteria that I mentioned earlier, they can be dangerous.
There's also been a lot of criticism in the media making too much of these so-called shooters and people who have problems, and kind of giving them the spotlight and going into their whole history and all of that. But I get into something else here, and that is Dr. Moss said that psychiatric drugs maybe are portrayed by the media as being much more dangerous than they are, because in more cases perhaps they offer help or assistance. But when we're talking about violent behavior that's out there, we're talking about other kinds of drugs. I mean, methamphetamine, all those kinds of drugs, aren't we?
Unfortunately, in my world, I used to call it my office, which is outside the four walls of this radio station and on the streets.
Is this in the Joe McNamara era?
To begin with, it started that way, yes. But to be honest, the term that we use is co-occurring disorder, and that is when you have someone who's in crisis, who's developing perhaps early onset schizophrenia, let's say, and they're 18, 19, 20, 21 in that age group, then they start to experiment with drugs. They clearly know that there's something not right. Maybe they start to have the command hallucinations where they're being told by some power, God, Martians, what have you, what to do. And then so what they try to do is cover up and mask those behaviors by taking some of the drugs on the street. And in my experience, and maybe Dr. Nah or Dr. Green can disagree, but in my experience as a hostage negotiator and a crisis intervention specialist on the streets, I never in my career came across someone who wasn't in crisis that wasn't experiencing a mental illness, either schizophrenia, bipolar, or severe depression, and or a personality disorder, then combining a co-occurring disorder with some kind of drug, so some kind of controlled substance. And when you have that mix, it's incredibly dangerous for the public safety, police officers, and others.
What about just when we talk about mental illness? I mean, there's so many varieties of it, and the great proportion, Dr. Green, is not necessarily dangerous to society or even to the people themselves. But when you look at some of these cases that we've been talking about and that we're examining here today, I mean, you do see some, I suppose, what can easily be clinically perceived as psychosis, what happened in Tucson to Gabby Gifford, for example, or what happened in Aurora, Colorado. And yet they were also very premeditative. They were well planned and well thought out and well executed.
Mm-hmm. You know, if they are different in that what we saw in Tucson, I believe, you know, we've seen a lot of evidence that's come out. He actually, that individual actually did look like he had schizophrenia and was psychotic. I mean, there's a lot of writing that came out on the internet about his thinking and stuff. And that is in contrast to the two incidents that have happened over the last week in Oregon and Connecticut. I think those individuals are slightly different. I think they all have the same aspect together, and that's they have some inability to regulate their emotions. For whatever reason, they get to that point. And the whole issue is that those aspects of them are not, you know, not addressed well enough. But to answer another point of yours, you know, you don't have to. There's another common misconception that people with mental illness just don't have any ability to understand or meditate or anything like that. There are so many different flavors of mental illness, so many different diagnoses, and so many different severities of any one diagnosis that any one individual can be different. I mean, you might see the people out on the street who are homeless who have a very advanced stage of schizophrenia in which they can't relate to you and they can't really discuss things, or people with negative symptoms of schizophrenia in which they can't communicate well. That's very different from the individuals who suffer from personality disorders. And a personality disorder is a problem with interacting with somebody else in society, basically. You know, these individuals have an illness and they have substantial impairment, but the impairment is how they interact with people in society. And that causes problems. But it's very much a mental illness, which very much needs to be treated. So the bottom line is there are all these different nuances of mental illness, and globally, there's a problem with addressing it and problem with resources about trying to minimize that mental illness, and a problem with society, but just trying to sweep it under the rug.
Yeah, let me go right to that question of resources. And Melissa and I, I'd like your take on this, because there's such budget pressure now that there's a lot of discharging earlier, and that adds to the complexity of this problem.
Absolutely. I think it's a huge problem we face where because we either don't have the resources or we know that we won't be able to we can't continue to run our hospital if the insurance companies won't pay because they don't believe that the patient is acute, meaning meeting criteria for involuntary hospitalization, then we come under pressure to have a patient leave the hospital earlier than we would prefer for treatment. And also, as far as what we're able to do from a legal standpoint as well, we can't, like I said earlier, we can't just confine people involuntarily for an indefinite period of time.
Hands are tied in so mm-hmm. many ways. I mean, the question comes down to what can we do more about prevention, particularly since hands are being tied more all the time because there's less money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the core question is what can we do? And I think, you know, I do think that we could find a middle ground, find a way to help mandate treatment for some people who are looking, and when I say looking, meaning who have been assessed and you know, clearly identified as meeting increased risk criteria, but who don't meet criteria for hospitalization. What can we do to mandate treatment for people who wouldn't actually want treatment? I also think we need to work on education for the public, as some of your other guests have mentioned. I mean, I think the stigma for mental illness, I think a common attitude of just the general public is not in my backyard. So as long as this person is, you know, the homeless person on the street, is as long as they don't, you know, affect my day-to-day life, I don't want to have to deal with it. And I really think as a society, we need to start to educate our children, educate one another for what are the risks, what are the signs of mental illness, and why is this, why should we treat it any differently than someone who has a cardiac disease or anything else for whom medications are considered appropriate and available and non stigmatized.
All right. I want to get our listeners involved in this and give them an opportunity to speak out and ask any questions or comments that may be indeed on your mind. On Sunday, as I mentioned earlier, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman called for a National Commission on Violence in the wake of the Newtown Massacre, and the commission is supposed to be looking into the country's mental health system as well as gun laws and other factors. Real question before us is, could better access to mental health services help prevent future tragedies or help to have prevented a tragedy of this scale? And we're talking about mental illness, public policy, and the psychology of those who commit these horrific acts. We welcome your involvement. You can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program. Again, toll free, 866-733-6786. And by the way, the article I cited is called "I Am Adam Lanza's Mother." It's by Lisa Long, not Lisa Lang. And there's a link of the article on our website if you would care to read it. You can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have or any contributions to the conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking this hour about mental illness and public policy and the psychology of those who commit these dreadful acts that we have seen, unfortunately, sporadically through recent American contemporary history. Melissa Naugh with us in studio is medical director of psychiatric emergency services with the San Francisco General Hospital. She's also assistant clinical professor at UCSF. And Greg Sancir is a former officer and hostage negotiator for the San Jose Police Department, a PhD in clinical psychology, now working as a danger assessment consultant for business and law enforcement and the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. John Green, psychiatrist, board certified in general and forensic psychiatry, and teaches psychiatry and law at Stanford School of Medicine. I want to go right to your calls here shortly, but there's a question right off the top here by a listener named Karen who says, how can we start helping the potentially thousands of parents out there trying to care for children with mental disabilities prone to rage and irrational behavior, and how can we help them before they become the mothers and fathers of another Adam Lanza? Where's the best place for citizens like me to get involved? Greg, go ahead.
Well, with the San Jose Police Department, we worked very closely with NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and they do tremendous things on a national scale with people with early onset mental illness and mental illness. They have a family course called Family to Family, which is, I believe, a 52-week course that family members can take to find out how they need to assist their loved ones, regardless of whether it's try to find out about medications, counseling, jobs, etc. And presently, I know that in Santa Clara County, NAMI is something that we in law enforcement really couldn't do what we try to do without, because the partnership is amazing. And
you can find them online.
Absolutely. And so I know that many people that the calls that I used to get, people wouldn't know where to begin or where to go. And I think that's what you're mentioning here. And I would send them in the direction of NAMI, and the folks there can help them and assist them with any other questions they have and help them to find out about the disease, treatment, et cetera.
Any other suggestions from Dr.
Yes,
Green,
I would say that NAMI's a good one. I think that, you know, every, at least in the United States, on this level, we do have access to mental health. We do have county facilities that are open. And I'll tell you, there are great professionals that always want to help in those facilities. Usually they're overstrapped, because the problem is we have limited resources. So, you know, on the global side of things, I would love to see change where, you know, we talk about mental illness as much as we talk about gun control. Mm-hmm. And we have access to that. If you're a parent right now and you have problems right now, I would say the best thing that you can do is become a squeaky wheel. You have to go forward, and you have to insist on care, because the first round of care that you get, I mean, it's one thing to go into a county facility and ask for access. You know, usually you're denied or moved away. I think that you just have to keep pressing on. I have seen a lot of people who have initially entered the mental health system who subsequently sort of drop out because the resources are not there, or because they're not being given enough direction themselves. I would say you just got to keep chugging at it.
Well, it's also, I think, self-evident that a lot of parents need to be urged. They feel this is their cross to bear, and they feel they have to take it on for themselves, and they just really need to be urged to action. Are you going to say something, Dr. Mo?
I was. That was exactly the point I was going to make, which is the other thing. I agree with both of the previous comments, and also to encourage people to talk to one another. Share your concerns about your child with your friends. Talk to people, get the support you need, and as a friend, don't stigmatize that mom or dad. Encourage them to, you know, work together to get through it, to talk about it. Don't shun them or shun their child because you don't understand it or you don't know what to do with it.
Let's bring our callers on here, and we begin, Carla, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. One of the things that you brought up was that it's very difficult once the child is an adult to get them help. My brother had a late diagnosed schizophrenia, early 30s. And for about 4 years prior, we knew something was very, very wrong. But it took until he beat my mother for us to get him into the criminal system and then get him help. He could have very easily killed her. And this shouldn't be the way that it goes down.
Well said. Well said. When you look back on it, Carla, what could you have done earlier that would have made a difference, do you think?
Consulted doctors and lawyers, and he wouldn't. He denied that there was something wrong. I mean, he heard voices coming out of his car, such that he ripped apart the dashboard with his bare hands. And obviously there's something wrong there.
Yeah. Well, what kept you from doing something even at that point when things were so obvious?
Well, there was nothing to do. Everything that we were told was that he has to be arrested for something, because he wouldn't voluntarily go to the hospital. He wouldn't voluntarily go to the doctor. He had to be arrested for something. And so he threatened to beat my mother, and I told her to go to the police, and she said she wouldn't. And I said, you have to get a restraining order. Otherwise, there's no paper trail, you know, and this woman was in her 70s. And we had to put that paper trail in place. So then when he did return to actually beat her substantially, that was in violation of a restraining order, so he was able to be booked.
Now, was I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Once he was charged and put in jail, then he was able to be transferred to the county mental health clinic, where he stayed for 5 weeks, seriously sedated on something, I don't know what it was, and then he was able to be released, and now that he takes his meds, he's fine. I mean, his personality is much different. He used to be really quick and quick-witted and funny and charming, and now he's kind of slow and plodding, but he's sweet. He doesn't have that anger or that psychosis.
Oh, Greg, Sincere, I mean, you've heard these kind of tales, unfortunately, too often, but there should have been earlier action here. And when you have no recourse except to use the criminal justice system, though, it's a sad commentary.
It is, and the problem here is one of, and Dr. Torrey alludes to this term called anosognosia, which is a part of the brain that literally shuts off that says, there's nothing wrong with me, whereas people surrounding that person can clearly see there's something wrong. She alluded to that he tore up the inside of his car, which is obviously has the potential to be turned into violence. And I've heard this story many, many times. What needs to happen is, I'm not sure where she lives, but perhaps she could have someone who is the crisis intervention team training of an agency in her area, and it need not even be where she lives. She can consult with a police officer who has the training, discuss the issues, and perhaps they can start to formulate a plan where the person can start to get the treatment. The problem exists where that person, once again, because of many of the civil rights that we enjoy in this country, won't admit to anything having been wrong with them until they commit an act where it gets people's attention. The community that I'm helping right now, the kids are scared now. So I'm going to actively start to contact this police agent and say, and lay it out for them. But unfortunately, the resource that it takes most places don't have that. And so what I encourage people do is try to find out if there's a CIT officer in your area, contact them, explain to what's going on with your loved one, get in touch with NAMI, and then it can be a concentrated effort from a number of groups to try to get that person the help that they need.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll bring you in, Rosemary, next. Hi. Welcome.
Hi there, Michael. Thank you for this program. I would like to move the discussion in a little bit different direction, and that has to do with power and how power is often related to guns. When my son was a member of the Boy Scouts 30 years ago, we promoted this participation until I read one of the Boy Scout magazines, and at the very back, there were numerous ads for rifles, and I questioned what was this promoting, and of course, it was touted as for hunting and for teaching the boys the proper use of guns. And I then was glad that he didn't go on to getting into that arena. But I noticed that boys who felt powerless were more attracted to those ads and to wanting to participate in the rifle sessions, etc. And then I'm very disturbed about the people in other states who want to have the right to carry guns in public and the swaggering that they display when they're out carrying their guns. And I would really like your guests to address this whole...
Well, you're talking really, Rosemary, about an important issue here, just the sense of, well, aggrandizement that can come, or power. I think you mentioned that word here, from owning a gun, particularly for young males, because most of this violence we're talking about is, unfortunately, perpetrated by young males. Some thoughts from you, Dr. Green?
Yes. What you're illustrating is that... you know, in society, there are images of guns. I mean, you know, if you look at the statistics of – well, not the statistics. If you look at the pictures of the individual from the Virginia Tech shootings, a lot of images of him holding guns and showing this power. And you find out that he was an individual who was very timid in society and very without power. So I think that the really important question is maybe not so much the guns, although that is an argument, but really – What would make an individual have that sense of loss? And really, that just speaks again to mental illness. I mean, if somebody needs guns to have power, you know, that's a bit like they need alcohol to feel important, or they need cocaine to feel important. And that's kind of the same argument. Well, that becomes a problem. The underlying issue needs to be addressed. If you address the underlying issue, I think that individuals would not have to resort to things like guns to have that feeling of power.
Now, here's another big underlying issue that we will take up tomorrow. At least that's the tentative plan. Sandra writes, we're missing a point when we talk only about gun control. Will we not discuss the desensitization of life we view on TV, at the movies, and on video games? Humans are complex creatures. We need to look at the issue of constant exposure to violence as a source of entertainment. How does this impact mental health? Are we willing to tell the entertainment industries that enough is enough? We need to take an integrated approach to deal with the complex issues and not compartmentalize our social problems into simply gun control or mental health. The entertainment industry needs to own up. Couldn't agree more. That's something we'll take up tomorrow and hear from different sides. But the desensitization is, just in mental health terms, really a problem here. I mean, you have these case histories. I'm sure both you and your psychiatric practices have seen them, where there's utter desensitization and also identification, not only with power with a gun, but with many of these superheroes or super villains, as in the case of Batman, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the problem is that, like the previous caller had mentioned, it's so very difficult when an individual is having impairment in mental illness, and everybody thinks that everybody in that individual's life agree, but the individual themselves emphatically say that they don't have a problem. That is the biggest block that I have in terms of treatment. It's so hard to get somebody on board, and I think a lot of that has to do with just general stigma. I mean, it's very hard for somebody to admit or to accept that they have an impairment. I think if there was an environment around in which stigma was less, then it might be easier for them to come forward.
You remember the mass killings in Norway? I mean, this is not American culture, but the one thing that he would not cop to in any way was any even trace of mental illness. He would not accept any kind of defense for himself along those lines.
Yes.
And then when you're more susceptible and you are mentally ill, of course, there's more of a tendency perhaps to identify with some of these kinds of violent things that we're talking about.
Absolutely. And when you are in that situation, it's very, very difficult for a professional like me to help you. And it's hard just the way the laws are set up now. That's why you get these situations where individuals, they commit a crime and then they're addressed.
Well, here's a listener who writes on our Facebook, on our website, the stigma over mental health makes me fear that I would not be accepted for health insurance with a mental health history. I would rather struggle with mental health and give up my access to physical health care, the elephant in the room.
There you go. That's the issue.
And that's one of the things. I'm presently the Foundation for Mental Health in Santa Clara County. One of the big issues is parity. One of the things we constantly discuss is trying to get parity between mental health and medical health, if you will, because we all know that there is no difference. But insurance companies, they're still not on board with that concept. But we know that, you know, the brain is a series of chemical interactions. And without that, then, you know, it takes the most reasonable person, just you put too much stress on them. And you hear the term bandied about a lot right now, and that's SNAP. any of us subjected to an incredible amount of pressure are susceptible to snap. Of course, we don't think that we can, but we can.
Well, here's some more on the question of stigmatizing mentally ill. Raul from Novato, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. I had a comment, but I think I'm going to go with something else, which is all the focus has been on the mental illness of the perpetrator or alleged mental illness. What about our collective illness about guns? I mean, the fact that we cannot seem to get we can't seem to move forward into a society where I have as much right to live safely from your gun as you have a right to own that gun. You know, the mother of that boy kept five or six guns in the house with a child that was significantly compromised in his judgment. So I think we need to look at ourselves as much as we look at the so-called mentally disturbed or mentally ill people.
Fair enough, Raul. You're back in some degree in the first hour here, but let me also go to some more comments from you, our listeners. Jane writes, this is a highly complex issue, and mental health is part of it. I'm really concerned by some of the posts and comments that say this isn't a gun issue, it's a mental health issue, or that the mentally ill should be institutionalized. It's also troubling that this did not seem to be a big concern until now that very young children are dead. And Mark writes on our website, in June, Governor Brown used his line item veto power to cut the early mental health initiative that had already been approved. The program helped students experiencing mild to moderate school adjustment difficulty. EMHI served over 15,823 students in fiscal year 2010 and 11 and has proved to be effective with a success rate of 79% improvement connected to this intervention. It's time to add this program back to the budget before it's too late. Addie asks, what are the underlying causes of mental illness? How does the U.S. compare to other countries? Maybe we should get some stats from those of you here that can provide them.
So, you know, really depends. John Green. So mental illness, you know, is such a broad concept. A broad definition. There's so many different mental illnesses. It really just depends on what you're talking about. Looking at schizophrenia, schizophrenia is a great one. That's like the worst of the worst of all the mental illnesses. That is about 1% of the population, and that's across the world. You know, it doesn't matter what country, what socioeconomic status. That's one.
Different varieties of schizophrenia too, right?
Different varieties.
There's paranoia, there's hebephrenic, yep. And catatonic. You know.
Exactly, exactly. If you look at all of those together, 1% of the population all the way across, wealthy people, poor people, everybody. And, you know, it's interesting to note that although it's 1% of the population, one in 100 roughly, you know, how often do you see them? You don't see them a whole lot. You know, you don't see individuals who suffer from schizophrenia. I certainly didn't see it when I was growing up.
Well, let me be blunt here for a moment, though, because, you know, psychiatric practice varies, too. I mean, one diagnosis from one psychiatrist may differ entirely from a diagnosis from another psychiatrist.
Well, you are, you know, you're pointing to a major problem with psychiatry, and that's, it's, you know, we don't have any psychiatry tests. You know, we can't stick somebody in a psychiatry x-ray and find out what the diagnosis is or draw their blood and find out particularly what their illness is. You know, we go off of a book, you know, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's basically a book that was designed by hundreds of psychiatrists sitting in a room saying, well, this is what schizophrenia looks like to me. What does it look like to you?
Changes all the time. We just did a program on the Alzheimer-Asperger continuum. I mean, but it's not only that. I mean, there were different names given to Adam Lanza's disorder by different people who had observed him and who thought that they were coming to conclusions about him. And they all involve different treatments. They all involve different ways of progressing.
Yeah. And I think the whole point is that everybody's kind of, you know, everybody speculates about what they see based on the evidence that's come forward in the internet. But I think the bottom line is he had something and it was very far down the road in which we identified it. You know, obviously, I mean, after the incident, what we need is some way to address that with him much earlier on.
Of course, behavior is very unpredictable, too. I mean, you can look at somebody and think they're going to be violent, and then they surprise you by not being violent. You look at somebody else who seems utterly passive. I mean, this has been the problem, particularly with the criminal justice system. Tiffany writes on our website, I'm currently interning at Access Institute, a community mental health clinic that provides quality, low-fee mental health services to individuals that otherwise would have no access to therapeutic services. And they're familiar with them, and they're really quite good. As the cry went out last week for increased gun control, my colleagues and I were instead sending out the cry for increased mental health services. In recent decades, governmental policies have stripped clinics of the ability to provide high-quality mental health care, and insurance policies have reduced the ability of psychologists to provide extensive care for those who need it. Let me go to more of your calls, and we go to Hillary next. Hillary, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm calling from Oakland. I'm a high school teacher in Fremont, California, and I run a peer resources program where I train teens to counsel other teens and do conflict mediation and teen advocacy work. One of your guests mentioned that when he was in school, he certainly didn't notice that there were kids with, you know, schizophrenia. But peer programs, what they do is that they educate kids to take a look at other people and to really notice what's going on around them to offer help. And if a program like this, like it is in our school, is part of the fabric of the school, kids are not as stigmatized to come forward and ask for help. They know that there are other teens around from whom they can get care. And when the teens that I train, if they need help, if they need support, there are resources out there as well. But I think that these are the kinds of programs that need to go into every single school. And I know that there are people who believe, well, school is for education, but it's a hub of a community. And all resources, everything comes there that people go and commit violent crimes in schools because you get the greatest concentration of people. So I think if you provide services there, if kids can provide service to other kids, if they see something, they say something. They become the eyes and the ears of a school. They want it to be a safe place, and that's why they do the work that they do. And I've done this for 14 years. I've seen it be extremely successful. And I think we need programs like this, you know, across the nation. I teach one period, you know, or actually I have a good program. I teach two periods a day. That's just a fraction of my salary, but I think the benefit in a program like this could be tremendous.
Thank you for that, and appreciate hearing from you. You want to say something here, John Green?
Yeah, and how much does that cost? You know, this is
an exact
example of what I'm talking about. Very little cost involved in that. You get involvement of individuals checking on their peers. They start to understand about mental illness. It costs little to nothing. I mean, if we had an organized front of situations like that, dramatically decrease issues with mental illness.
Well, as long as we're talking about money, Melissa Nau, we've got a listener here, Jerry, who writes, "We often hear our experts support the idea that the society and healthcare system does not appropriately fund mental health. Few would disagree that more can be done. Can you tell us about or point to any studies of the amount of funding that would be appropriate?"
That's an excellent question. I don't have particular numbers. I would actually speak to the concept of parity that was brought up earlier by Dr. Sancerre. I think that, you know, Obamacare is trying to, for whatever the criticisms are of that legislation, I think the central concept of parity, of not refusing treatment for pre-existing conditions, are central to getting more resources. I don't have specific numbers about how much it would cost, though.
Not sure where you get them either, but maybe some listeners will have a suggestion or two. Let me go to another online here. Heidi, hi. Join us.
Yes. Hi. How are you? I've called before a long time ago, but it's really touched me because my family is full of schizophrenics, and my child was diagnosed with extreme bipolar disorder at the age of 3. I have gone through social services. I have called CIC officers, who, by the way, are good. But the regular officers are absolutely atrocious. And what I learned as a parent contact for other parents of bipolar children is that even through mental health services, there is no respite. There is no, even my daughter has become severely ill with physical illnesses. She's on disability. We've gone to hospitals where they've thrown her out recently. 60 times she was in, blaming her because she was mentally ill. It turned out she had some severe thing that may be called central pain syndrome. What I'm saying is most of our people were dumped out on the streets in the 70s, and there are books you can read on this. And basically what we need to do is reinstitute very nice condominium-type living situations for paranoid schizophrenics, the real scary ones, if they're not going to take their medication, and for those that are having psychosis. And sometimes medications don't always work. My daughter's severely allergic to certain meds that cause cardiac problems.
So my answer to this is reinstitutionalize nice places for people to live safely with support systems. And instead of paying $80,000 to $150,000 to put a mentally ill person in jail, give them outside services. I think it's $12,000 or $15,000 a year to keep them housed.
What do you think, Greg Sincere? Let me get some response from Greg on this, and thank you for that suggestion, Heidi. Good to hear from you.
Well, once again, I think Dr. Nau alluded to it. Clearly, it's a dollars and cents issue, but I think that in New York, I know they had a facility dedicated to homeless / mentally ill, which was quite successful. And I know in Palo Alto, the Foundation for Mental Health has a couple of homes that they've restored into live-in mental health facilities, and I couldn't agree more. When I was on the Prop 63 committee some years ago with a number of professionals throughout the valley, we alluded to trying to get the funding to enable us to fund a quote-unquote mental health facility that had wraparound care, so it had medication, clinicians, you know, the necessary need for law enforcement if it was precipitated, counseling care and all those types of things. But once again, you know, we're back to the almighty dollar and trying to devote the kind of funding that's necessary for that. When it has been done, it is successful. But once again, it comes down to the money aspect.
Now let me thank the caller and read a few more of listeners' postings. Danielle writes, I've worked with severely emotionally disturbed children as a mental health provider. I think we could possibly prevent this by having more psychologists test children who display psychological disturbance and make it mandatory to have homeschool children have a psychological evaluation every year. We also need more services for the mentally ill, such as intensive hospital stays. And Kendra says, treating the mentally ill as criminals is not a long-term solution and a travesty of human rights. Not treating at all leads to tragedies like this. Improvement of care needs to be part of the solution. And a number of listeners saying, well, you know, mental health isn't as big a problem as guns. Guns aren't as big a problem as mental health. And so it goes. But I think what we've learned today to a great extent is these things work together. Melissa Nau, you're going to comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to keep in mind that I think that I very much support enhanced outpatient treatment programs, enhanced inpatient treatment programs. But I think that getting into the realm of everyone with schizophrenia should live in a certain environment, for example, is very dangerous and potentially unhelpful for our society. I think that there are plenty of people that I treat and see on a regular basis with schizophrenia, the worst kind of mental illness, as someone else mentioned, who function very well in society, hold jobs, are able to absolutely maintain a high level of organization and contribution to society. So I think that our focus should really be on people's behavior.
Well, there's also a lot of focus, I can tell you, from many of these emails and web postings on the need for more services, and that's certainly come through here very dramatically. I could read emails for the next half hour about the necessity for more services or web postings, but we have come to the end of this hour, and I want to extend thanks to all of you. Melissa Nau is Medical Director of Psychiatric Emergency Services at San Francisco General Hospital, and Greg Sincere is former police officer and hostage negotiator, presently working as a danger assessment consultant, and John Green is a psychiatrist at Stanford, teaches psychiatry there. Thank you for being with us this hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.